How safe do you think the stock market really is? And what if I told you it really just enables a whole lot of Wall Street skimming? Hello, everyone. Dr. Chris Martinson here at Peak Prosperity. We are carrying on with our Great Taking series, and we're coming into the landing. I've got one more episode, which is going to be the final summary coming out, but before we get there, now we're on part 8, the Great Taking, Wall Street skimming operation. Of course, the Great Taking is that amazingly wonderful Service to Humanity book by David Rogers Webb. I have taken that, followed all the references, gone deeper, and this is one of those times that we are going in a lot deeper today just to figure out what is going on. What are the punchlines of the Great Taking? We've been down this before. One, part one, we covered the idea that you're not the owner of your stocks and bonds. You have a security entitlement. But above your security entitlement, there are other claimants who do have senior claims depending on the kind of account you hold. And these are mostly big banks, gigantic financial institutions, and most of these are derivative contracts. And all the way at the bottom in part four, we covered that, well, those derivatives, well, now they're larger than the value of everything in the world. Potentially. As long as everything's working right, derivatives are awesome. If things go a little pear-shaped, if things run out, fat tails, you know, a couple standard deviations out of what's expected, that's when the trouble starts. Okay, today we're going to talk about how really the whole system is just too convoluted really to grasp at this point in time. So, hey, this is what we did. We put together the pieces. We discussed your entitlement claims. We talked about, well, who are the senior claims? These are what are called qualified financial contracts. We covered what happens during a bankruptcy. Uh-oh, turns out very, very small levels of capital out there to cover things up should there be a giant hiccup like the great financial crisis again, which is coming. And what happens when financial stability is invoked as a term? That's a little squishy. But they can change the rules, and they probably will change the rules. Guess what, citizen? Not in your favor is the usual answer to that. And so we're going to talk about why we have so much risk right now. There are these two systems out there right now. First, it used to be direct ownership, right? You had stock certificates. Now, pros and cons. Hey, the ownership was clear. Processes were really simple to understand. The risks of conduct were well understood and delineated. And by the way, thank you, Jimmy, for giving me all of this part for this. That's from talking with a lawyer with a lot of experience in this area. So I've been very fortunate to have some real experts helping me understand this so I can help you understand it. I am your information scout, after all. The cons of direct ownership. Well, you know, the transfers of securities are really slow and unwieldy. Trading is slower. It's cumbersome. Paper certificates can be lost. The whole process under paper was such a ridiculous process nightmare. Like they would get a big file folder of the day's trades, and they would have to have sometimes powers of attorney attached, signature matching slips attached. Sometimes they didn't check out. It was just paper going everywhere. They had process after process after process. Because the point here is to say, hey, I owned it. Now you bought it. You own it. But there's all these intermediaries, right? You got your brokers. You got your exchanges. It's tricky. What do you do? So they came up with this idea that said, well, let's do indirect ownership, right? And that's where, you know, looks more like this. There's security intermediaries and entitlement holders, just like we've been talking about. This is a very, very, very simplified, overly simplified schematic here. Again, pros and cons. Pros, hey, this stuff is represents easier transfer, faster transfer, much lower cost of trading execution, no risk of lost certificates, but other risks that could include loss of data. That's different risk. Clear portfolio views, reconciliations, all of this is actually much easier to do, guess what, in a computer than with stacks of paper. No surprise there. Some cons. The cons include additional complexity in the system now, and with additional complexity, you get more what we might call raccoons in the story, right? If you're a farmer like I am, a raccoon is an animal that's too clever by half. It really knows its own interests very well, but if it gets in your henhouse, it'll pretty much kill all your hens, right? Not thinking ahead, clever enough to come in and do the damage, but not clever enough to figure out how to avoid what the larger impacts of its cleverness actually are. That's Wall Street in a nutshell. So we also have dependence on computer systems. This gives the possibility of spoofing. Now we have deepfakes with all this AI stuff going on. We have lack of equal market access. Talk about that more today. And clarity for all. We don't have we don't have equal clarity in the market structures, what I'm saying there. Risks of hacking, electromagnetic pulses, that's an EMP, et cetera, et cetera. So there's some things that could happen in the indirect ownership model, but it's not as clear cut as just saying one's good, one's bad, pros and cons, right? So I think that this indirect ownership model makes a lot of sense as long as you live in a world of morality and vigorous, equal enforcement of the law. And as we've covered, especially for my subscribers, you know that we've been covering this for a while, that when you see these court cases come out over and over again, it's very not impartial and very much capricious, arbitrary. And of course, if you're in favor with the ruling party of the day and or the judge or the system and or the money interests, you tend to get more favorable rulings than everybody else. So that's the purpose of pointing all this out and covering this with you is, you and I, we're on the outside with our noses pressed up against the glass looking in, and I no longer have trust in our justice system in the United States. I don't know how you feel about it in Europe, but I'm very clear on what's going on here. Our justice system has now been absolutely perverted. It doesn't follow the rule of law. It does mysterious things, but not that mysterious when you notice the trend is always the same. The big, powerful interests get their way, little people get squished. And I'm definitely one of the little people, like you. We all are. The great paperwork crisis began back in, they say, in the 1970s, late 60s, early 70s, when they're like, we can't handle all this paper anymore. That was when there were about 200, 250 million shares per day were trading. That was swamping the system. So they had this great paperwork crisis. And then we see up through early 1988 up through 1987 and 80, something happened there. And then we came back down to under 500 million shares a day. And then look, it's up to 2.5 billion shares a day on April 4th, 2024. My most recent data, I could pull 11.39 billion shares traded on the New York exchanges alone. Okay. And that's just in what we would call the light pools. We'll talk about the dark pools. Now, when I said it's just a complicated system that enables raccoons to come in and feast on that system, this is literally what it looks like. And I apologize for how small all blurry all that is. This comes out of, this was a code of federal regulations. They were looking in 2015, SEC was saying, hey, we would like to make some big changes to the laws. And they were looking for public input. And so this is one of the pieces they put in there to show what happens. And I'll get my drawing tool out here real quick. Let's use the highlighter. So up here at the top, this is an issuer. So let's say Microsoft is going to sell some stock. They have to then hand that over to a transfer agent here, right? And the transfer agent is going to push that in through the FAST system, which is DTCC's thing. And then Seed and Company is going to be named the owner of this whole thing. It is as typical if this is registered in street name. Here is the Depository Trust Corporation, DTC. And it's got its other C down here from the NSCC. So let's just say you're a buyer here and you want to just buy a share. You want to buy a share of Microsoft. What do you do? Well, you put in your buy order here and then it goes over here to your introducing broker. Yeah. Who's, your prime broker there, whoever you're using, they initiate and put into their system a buy order, which goes out here. And it comes into a clearing broker somewhere. This is some sort of DTC participant. They have to then push this order off down here. It comes over into the National Securities Exchange. And then that information flows up to the NSCC here. And then that information flows back up through here and on and on and on and on and on. All like you haven't even got your share yet. You know, so that's all the plumbing that's happening behind the scenes when you buy something. Now, again, this is fast. It's efficient. 11, 10, 12 billion shares a day can be traded. No problem, right? It can manage all of that. One thing I want you to take away from this, though, is that actually every single shape on this chart and every single line costs money, right? People don't just operate clearing exchanges without employees, without overhead, without fixed costs, without securing profits for themselves. Every broker's got to make their living and wage as well. I have no complaint with that, but just when we say, oh, this is a lot more cost efficient, it's not actually. This enables what I call the skimming operation. And that's why this whole thing of understanding how indirect ownership allowed us to do some things that were sold to us all the time. That's all they tell us about. Oh, this is much more cost efficient. Look, you can get on Robinhood and press a button and buy a share and sell a share, and it costs you just, you know, a few cents or even, you know, a dollar or two a trade, right? That's so much more efficient. That would have cost you $10, $12, $15 back in the old days. See, better. However, this is just enabling more volume, and they're taking smaller pieces off of each volume. Wall Street always gets its cut. It's a skimming operation. I mean, did you ever see Wolf of Wall Street? And we've got Leonardo DiCaprio and Michael McConaughey in that really classic scene. They're in a restaurant, I assume that's in the World Trade Center, and they're having that lunch. And Matthew McConaughey's just pounding, you know, the martinis and the lines, and whoa, 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 and he does this, and he explains the biz to a young ingenue, Leonardo DiCaprio in this case, and says, "Hey, here's how this works. We go home with cash at the end of every day. Your job is to keep the investors fully invested. But we put cash in our pockets every day and we go home. Same as it ever was. That is the game. The game is for Wall Street to separate us from our money. It's their job. That's what they do. And they do it really, really well." Okay. So this is the overall market structure here. And it's really, really complicated. And additional complexity simply means that you have to have rules, you have to have laws, you have to have increasingly complicated laws. There's exceptions, there's things that can happen. They had to disintermediate all of us, so we are no longer the owners of our shares anymore. We are now security entitlement holders because the ownership structure had to be pushed off somewhere else. And they still tell you, hey, look, it's fast and cheap and easy, and you still get paid your dividends. But do you ever wonder what, you know, there's two things that really come with owning a share of a company. That's an ownership stake. One thing is the dividends you might get, right? If your company pays dividends. The second thing, though, is you get to vote. You have a say in how that company is run. Shareholder rights are a big deal. When's the last time you had your broker call you up and say, hey, we're really interested in your how you would throw your vote on these particular issues that affect the companies that you own shares in? I'm going to guess zero times. Never is probably how that's gone, because that's actually real power. Real power is being able to dictate what goes on in these companies, and that belongs to the shareholders, full stop. And so that's often also disintermediated. So we no longer technically own our shares, and we no longer technically or even practically or realistically weigh in on the operational aspects of the companies that we're invested in. So the whole thing's been kind of pushed forward. Now, well, speaking of Wall Street and its skimming operations, and by the way, every single one of these lines and shapes in here allows another skim to be handled. And that's just for the physical execution side. There's a whole other rotational aspect. We can look at this and say, wow, this level of complexity also enables various grifts and skims to be operated within the system because it's so complicated. We're going to talk about those now. So first up, at the top end, we find out in 2023, Wall Street profits were up to $26.6 billion, and the bonus pool in yellow at the bottom is about the same. $33.8 billion in bonuses is going out to Wall Street workers. This is just, and by the way, this is just the front-facing part of Wall Street. There's another side which doesn't report. They don't have to, not public companies. They don't tell us what their earnings were. And by the way, in 2021, in the aftermath of all that money printing from COVID, Wall Street had a banner year that year too, $42.7 billion, again, in public-facing companies that are going to tell us about what their bonuses were. And of course, we find out about this because New York State's Comptroller's Office is very keenly interested in how many taxes it can levy upon said bonuses. Now, where did that money come from? $42 billion, $33 billion, $26 billion. These are big numbers. Where did that money come from? Ah, Wall Street is all about taking money from other people. That's what it does. Wall Street doesn't create anything. It builds no boats. It doesn't plow a single field. There's no staircases built. Nothing happens in Wall Street. It is a skimming operation, full stop. Trading is a zero-sum game. Your gain is my loss. My gain is your loss. It's zero. Yeah, you sum those two numbers up, it comes out to zero. So where did that come from? Where did that $33 billion come from? It didn't just arise out of the magic of value creation within a robust economy. That's cash. That's cash that went home at the end of the day in their pockets. Now, where did that cash come from? Well, obviously, it comes from within that larger ecosystem. Somehow, that cash got extracted from this process. All right. Well, you know, it's a very ancient apocryphal story. It goes like this. Once in the dear dead days beyond recall, an out-of-town visitor was being shown the wonders of New York financial district. When the party arrived at the Battery, one of his guides indicated some handsome ships riding at anchor, and he said, "Look, those are the bankers' and the brokers' yachts." "Where are the customers' yachts?" asked the naive visitor. And it's an old joke, right? There are no customers' yachts, right? So that's how it's always been. And this these stories go back to the 20s and all that. It's fine. Okay. Now, this whole system has some enormous risks baked in it. And that's what I'm going to be talking about in part two for my subscribers back at Peak Prosperity. I am everybody's information scout. I've just put out so much content lately because there's so much to talk about in this day and age. And if you're interested in becoming a member, if you like context, if you want to have some time saved for you, having somebody you trust come in and scour the world's news and then distill it and present it to you, hey, that's my job. And so we'd love to have you there. You are cordially invited to become a member at Peak Prosperity. And we'd love to have you. Now, where did that money come from? Well, now we're going to focus down on a company called Citadel. It's the one of the largest hedge funds based in the U.S., approximately $92 billion in total assets. It's generated $74 billion in gains, they call this, since its inception in 1990. Again, Citadel, what does it make? Nothing. Founded by Ken Griffin, Citadel was the second best performing hedge fund in 2023, raking in $8.1 billion in profits in 2023. So, no, I decry this. So, profits is like when Whirlpool takes some raw steel and fashions it into a washing machine and then sells that. That profits are the excess of, that's the value creation. $8.1 billion is from skimming. That's nothing got created. That was, somebody else didn't get that $8.1 billion. That went to Ken Griffith and Citadel. That's what happened. So we really need to separate financialization from industrialization. Industrialization and even good quality service providers, right? That's real profits. Human effort goes into making this stuff. When you make money using money, that's financialization. Totally kind of different, right? In my perfect world, that would be taxed at a higher marginal rate than income from labor, but that's exactly upside down. Of course, because these guys and gals have all the money and they give that money in pathetically small amounts to congressmen and senators who then write the laws that enshrine their relative advantage. Now, okay, but still, you know, trading, full contact sport, I can make a case for why, okay, maybe something of a case for that. But when you're just flat out skimming, no values being added at all, though they work hard to try and talk about that. Now, as a sidebar, it was totally not suspicious when Bernanke left his Federal Reserve chairmanship position in 2014 and then immediately in 2015 joined Citadel as an advisor. Because as you know, a company that's mostly known for what's called high-frequency trading, and I'll talk to you about that in a second. That's what Citadel does a lot of. Yeah, you know what they need? They need somebody who's like Ben Bernanke, who's going to advise them on macro monetary trends. This is payoff. This is how the payoff works right here. Ben Bernanke did his job, ruined the country, you know, with his monetary vandalism. And now he's being rewarded with a plum cushy job. I bet you anything. He just sits in his office there, twiddles a pencil. Nobody asks him anything because nobody cares. Every so often he'll be invited to a meeting and people will say, "Thanks, Ben. You know, here's your paycheck." I'm pretty sure that's the system that's operating. Okay, so skimming. Let's talk about just the skimming now. Remember, we have this highly complicated system with all these little boxes and charts and lines and flows and databases and we got clearing parties and all of this stuff. And Citadel Securities, according to Wiki, I think this is from 2021, said claims to trade, and this was in a Senate hearing, I believe, or a House hearing, they had to fess up and they claimed that they traded approximately 26% of all U.S. equities volume. So I said, wow, if you had 11, you know, I'll make it easy. If you had 10 billion shares trading that day, right, 2.6 billion of those are flowing through this one company. Now, how do you trade that much? How are you that in the center of everything? Well, that's because they're running a skimming operation. And they also execute approximately 47% of all U.S. listed retail volume. Oh, you're trading through Robinhood. Citadel's got your number, right? And they get to front run that, and they get to see your order flow. They get to figure out that if you were willing to pay X, but they can find, you know, a share out there for X minus one penny and then sell it to you. Like, they're just coming in and constantly, you can't lose this, right? You own the order book. You get to see that here's what people are willing to pay. Here's all the prices out here. And you just start matching so that you make money. And there you go. Good business if you can get it, right? And get this, as a market maker, as a specialist market maker or market maker with respect to 99% of all traded volume in 3,000 U.S. listed options names. Oh, I mean, they are the market. And that's just what we know about. That's on the light pools. There's something else called dark pools, which is off exchange. On exchange is about 2/3. Off exchange is about 1/3 of the total volume, at least as of October, November, 2018. I don't know what the, I couldn't find more recent data easily when I was setting this up. I'm sure it's out there. I just missed it. So, you know, you hear about how many shares traded on the New York Stock Exchange and the red wedge up there or on the NASDAQ, et cetera. But then there's all this other stuff going on in the back end. And you see Citadel's back there. They're back there in the dark pools, which basically means there are trades happening and prices being set in ways that you can't see. They're not available. They're not lit. You don't see them. They're not things happening on your trading tape, right? There's an extraordinary information asymmetry, knowing what's happening in the dark pools compared to the light pools. And if you can bridge that gap, you can find all the little arbitrage opportunities where there's a gap. An information gap, which means often a price gap. And when you have that, now you get to do your skimming operation. And ta-da, we earned $8.1 billion by basically operating what's called insider trading by any other name, right? Which is operating with an informational disadvantage to the general public. So, but that's the system we have. That is the system. So I've talked about this high frequency trading. What is it? From Investopedia, it's, they say here down below, using powerful computer programs to transact a large number of orders in a fraction of a second. Not just a large number of orders. High frequency trading in yellow over there refers to trading that utilizes computers to process a significantly large number of transactions within nanoseconds. That would be billionths of a second. Nanoseconds? High frequency trading is important because the faster a transaction occurs, the quicker and most likely the larger a profit on a trade will be. You're thinking, I've analyzed the annual report for this company and I think that, you know, there's got some advantage to it. I would like to buy that. That's not the game. This has nothing to do with fundamentals. This is all, there are rules. There's a system. It's complicated, if not complex. And they figured out, these raccoons, how to get in there and just feast like piranhas on this whole thing. Now, I've got raccoons and piranhas, so I don't know. Whichever animal you bond with more closely as a shystery, you know, skimmer. High frequency trading has been shown, here they're justifying, has been shown to improve market liquidity and has made trading on markets more efficient, particularly removing bids and offers that are too small and by matching the many bids and offers in a marketplace quickly. Not just quickly, they have to do it so quickly that to have an edge on this, they now do what's called server exchange co-location. Quote, server or exchange co-location is a practice of placing the computers in charge of executing trading algorithms as close as possible to the stock exchange, if not on the stock exchange floor, right? Why? Because the speed of light starts to matter at the speed these things are operating at, right? So you want your cable as short as possible because you want your photons or electrons to travel the shortest distance so that you can be that much in front of somebody else who's trying to run this sort of a strategy, right? If you are literally a microsecond behind, which is a millionth of a second, you're out, baby. You're toast. No bueno. So it's amazing that this is the system we have, and that's what the exchanges look like now. That top picture, they're not people in yellow, orange, red, blue, yellow jackets running around doing stuff. It's computers firing stuff off really, really fast. And then, ta-da, Wall Street earned $32 billion last year, you know, or whatever the numbers happen to be. Carrying on, quote, institutions that benefit from co-locating their strategies, that's their computers, close to the exchange matching engine, can rent cabinets in the same data centers where the exchanges run their back-end services. Oh, so it is not really, not near, in the same cabinets. So, like, I need my server parked in this cabinet right next to Wall Street servers, right? And a little tiny cable. Haha, I win, right? And so as a consequence, large institutions that specialize in high frequency trading pay generous fees to the exchanges for the right to place their hardware inside those data centers. So the exchange makes more money and these people are paying that because they make more money. But again, where did that money come from? Oh, that comes from everybody who's executing trades, right? It has to come from somewhere. This is just an accounting identity. It's axiomatically true. One man's loss is another man's gain. So when Wall Street's making all of these gains by co-locating their servers and running all these fancy algorithms and conducting trades in nanoseconds, they do that because they make money at it. Your money. It has to come from somewhere. So when we talked about the pros and cons, indirect ownership, hey, it's fast, it's efficient, it's, you know, cost efficient. At the same time, it's enabled this enormous, enormous industry that's highly dependent on these sorts of practices to emerge. And what a fascinating thing to me is, you see, as an example, the matching engine for the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is located in Aurora, Illinois. So here's a fun little story for you in the aftermath of the Superstorm Sandy in 2011. What happened was the New York Federal Reserve said, oh, continuity of operations, we're scared. We got that. That was a wake-up call. What if our trading floor had gotten taken out? We're going to move our trading floor somewhere. Where should we move that? Oh, I know, Aurora, Illinois. Whole story there. You should know about at some point, but I'm like Bernanke going to Citadel. I'm like, I'm a little suspicious, right? Because the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is where really high leverage, tail wag the dog sorts of products that move markets and move them quickly. That's where they are traded, in rooms that look more like that. And New York Federal Reserve decided, oh, let's just move our trading center right there too. So that they can execute these trades more quickly and potentially move markets more quickly, which is why I editorially would support a transaction level audit of the Federal Reserve's operations, because we deserve to know what that quasi-public institution who prints money out of thin air is doing with that. But if they are using it specifically to engineer outcomes in markets, and that is not publicly known, and I don't have that same information, but insiders who, like Citadel, who Ben Bernanke just went to work for, if they have access to that information, now I begin to get suspicious about whether how much of that $8.1 billion they earned legitimately in the scrum of marketplaces outcompeting other piranhas and raccoons, and how much of that $8.1 billion came because they got the bat phone call about what was about to happen. These are the sorts of questions that arise in a non-transparent system. It's a legit question. I think we all deserve answers. Okay, off of my editorial horse, let's carry on. Okay, so that whole system right there, that is actually, it's a really well-oiled machine. You see this beautiful transmission here, like cutaway view. It's a beautiful, well-oiled machine. But what risks does it face? Well, as we talked about in part four of this, we talked about these derivatives here. And, you know, the derivatives, they're either $1 quadrillion or 2.3 quadrillions, whatever. It's a really big number. We don't know. And it's all beautiful. The derivatives mostly net out as long as everything stays within parameters, as long as the bands stay tight. But if this thing ever fat tails out and we have a high sigma event, like a 3 sigma, 4, 5, 6 sigma financial earthquake, right? Then all of a sudden the derivatives don't net out. And then all of a sudden we find out that those are qualified financial contracts that then come in and begin to weigh in on a legal basis with your claims, potentially, depending on your brokerage and your account type, weigh in on your claims for your stocks and bonds. So I think my view of this is that actually this whole thing is a beautiful, beautiful system. And it works great as long as the derivatives don't go fat tail on us. And when they do, it'll look more like this finely tuned piece of equipment down here. It'll just completely break, and nobody will be able to get this little machine back into being that machine over there, right? This one can't become this one again. Very difficult. It's going to be a really hard thing to do. Now, what's fascinating is that if you sign up for a brokerage account, okay, and this is like a typical statement here, it's 54 pages long. I didn't copy and paste every single page, but this is a really long thing. And by the way, when I queried it, I started asking some questions, like how many times did it mention the word security entitlement? That when you sign up for a brokerage account and you buy, you know, securities with us, how many do they inform you that you're going to have a securities entitlement? The answer is zero. It occurs zero times. Like all the things we've been talking about, this is a really big, long, giant contract that is 54 pages. Most people won't even read all that gobbledygook. They'll sign and they'll get their brokerage account opened up, and almost nothing is disclosed. I found one little disclosure over there in the yellow. So let's look at this a little bit more closely. It says here, if you have a margin account, okay, remember there's two types of accounts, cash and margin. If you have a margin account, we may sell your securities or other assets without contacting you. Some investors mistakenly believe that Fidelity or any brokerage, this would be very typical brokerage language, must contact them for a margin call to be valid, and that Fidelity cannot liquidate securities or other assets in their accounts unless Fidelity has contacted them first. This is not the case. Don't be mistaken. Fidelity may attempt to notify you of margin calls, but is not required to do so. In addition, even if Fidelity has contacted you and provided a specific date by which you can meet a margin call, they can still take the necessary steps to protect its financial interests prior to that date, including immediately selling the securities without notice to you. Oh, carrying on, last paragraph. Note that property in a margin account may be pledged or repledged or hypothecated, that is loaned, or rehypothecated, loaned and then a derivative of a loan and loaned twice, right? Either separately or in common with any other property for as much as your obligation to us or more without having to retain a like amount of similar property in our control for delivery. What? Did you understand what they just said there? They're just like, dude, you think you own your stocks and bonds? Sorry, they're in a margin account. We might decide to, you know, sell them, loan them, pledge them, put them somewhere. And we don't even have to offset that with something in another account. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's all good. Also, we may at any time and without notice to you transfer any property between any of your accounts, whether individual or joint, or from any of your accounts to any account you guarantee. And as permitted by law, we may use certain securities for, among other things, settling short sales. Da, 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 da. Okay. Again, indirect ownership, direct ownership, margin accounts, cash accounts, they have lots of wrinkles. What's interesting to me, though, is that these wrinkles are really not well disclosed. This is something that I think it would be even difficult for me after all of my training in this and reading of this and knowing how my capacity for understanding things like this is pretty high. And even with that, I'm not totally clear exactly what just happened in these paragraphs down here. They did disclose it, but that last paragraph down there is like, this might happen. It may happen. We could do this. We might do that. We could transfer things between accounts. Like they basically just said, listen, what's ours is ours and what's yours is ours, I guess. And they don't at any point in here explain who's going to actually secure the benefit from that I could find. Because if they loan that out, they're loaning it out for a term, for a fee. When somebody has to borrow a share short, which they might be borrowing from your margin account, they're going to pay a fee for that. Or is the fee? Couldn't find it. And I'm sure it's buried in there somewhere, but it's too complicated. It shouldn't be this complicated. Now, if things really do go pear-shaped, though, don't worry. SIPC will be there to cover you. And that says SPIC. That should say SIPC. Sorry about that. And so they have $3.5 billion to possibly cover all possible claims. And as we know, there are many, many, many trillions of dollars of stocks and bonds outstanding in various brokerage accounts. So is that a sufficient amount? Well, it has proven to be sufficient all through its founding up to now. Will it prove to be sufficient in the future? We don't know. Probably not, is my guess. And the reason for that is that we haven't actually tested these new seniority qualified financial contract claims with derivatives at the top of the heap during a major financial crisis. We'll see what happens with that during the next crisis. And don't worry, these are the fine people standing between you and disaster. That is literally the entire SIPC staff. So if you had any qualms about wondering if they have the manpower to handle a Six Sigma financial cataclysm, fear not. The other part of this, of course, is what happens during, this is really a legal challenge, is what's going to happen during the next financial crisis with all this gobbledygook and all the skimming and all the financial complexity and systems. If they go dark and we have to reconstruct that, or there's big bankruptcies and we have to reconstruct that, you're going to have to rely on the justice system to be fair, impartial, and timely in how it adjudicates all of this. And we found out from MF Global, that's John Corzine, of course, he had a firm, MF Global, that went in and literally took money out of client accounts, which is the biggest no-no there is, segregated client accounts, in order to post collateral to some outside firms that he was getting money from, because his firm, under his tutelage, made some really bad bets on some derivatives that blew up in their face. Okay. At any rate, he said, you know, in front of the Agricultural Committee, because why Agricultural Committee? Probably because these were commodities futures contracts. Anyway, I simply do not know where the money is, or why accounts have not been reconciled to date. Oh, like it's like, I don't, your officer, I don't know what the smoking gun is doing in my hand or why that person is bleeding out over there. I don't know. Yeah, it's just it's like the lamest excuse ever. And you know what happened to him? Nothing. Nothing. Years later, they finally tagged him with a $5 million fine, but he's not even forbidden from working within, like he could open a hedge fund if he wanted to. Nothing happened. And this is the most egregious thing I could possibly imagine. So regardless of whether how much he should have been punished, for sure, the system needed to communicate to us, the clients, the people with customer accounts, we got your backs. When somebody does something like this, we make an example out of them. Hopefully that sends a message to all the other players. No message sent. In fact, the wrong message was sent. The message that was sent was, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You do what you do, right? Be as outrageously, fraudulently, criminally culpable as you want to be, and nothing's going to really happen to you as long as you're part of the protected class. So I guess this whole thing is like, if you, that your sense of how fairly treated you think you will be within the legal system is really an assessment of how closely you are aligned with the political interests of the judiciary at this point in time. I think that's how I have to interpret that. At any rate, you can read about this at your leisure, freeze the frame if you want to. I covered this with my subscribers a couple weeks ago. And we see here, this is just talking about how there was a $5 million settlement. And down below there, it says, Mr. Corzine agreed to harsher undertaking than this poor underling who got blamed for the whole thing, which is just not appropriate. He's accepting a lifetime prohibition from leading a futures broker or registering with the CFTC. In effect, that means he will not personally trade other people's money in the futures industry. Solid. Except for smaller trades under certain threshold limits. What? Well, what? Oh, in theory, he could still operate a hedge fund that does futures trading. And he could trade for his own account. It also doesn't prevent him from trading in other markets. Ooh! Very painful how the insiders treat themselves. So, hey, conclusions for today. Thank you so much for making it this far. First up, Indirect Holdings. You know what? Hey, it's fast. It can handle larger volumes cheaply, effectively. People want that convenience. People like going on their phones and hitting the buy button and having it work. I get it. That's a product that people actually want. But I think we should understand that that required that ownership be disintermediated. It got reduced to entitlements. And those aren't often very well disclosed or explained, because it has huge impacts potentially, particularly in margin accounts. And it's very difficult to get that understanding from the industry. It's done a great job of keeping it all kind of hidden up to now, right? And the system is now so complex, so labyrinthian, that nobody really understands it. And of course, that's why I think the Federal Reserve et al. Have been so busy manipulating the markets and making sure they always go up and to the right and rescuing them at any one moment. As I've often said, a relationship goal is to find somebody who loves you and spends as much time and attention on you as the Federal Reserve does on the U.S. stock market. Now, I think that's because the Federal Reserve is just scared, like everybody, like nobody, no one person actually understands how this market works anymore. So they're afraid of that complexity because if it breaks, oh no, emergency. And that complexity has also, as a feature or a bug, depending on your point of view, allowed Wall Street's raccoons to get busy and begin fleecing the public in new ways. Now, it's always done this, but this allows new ways and ways you can't even detect. Like, oh, well, they took a fraction of a penny in a nanosecond. Who really cares? Well, $8.1 billion later, you're like, dude, where'd that come from? Like, it's adding up. This is starting to get painful. And of course, you would want to always know the answer to this question, which is they rarely exist. So, your faith that the system is holding your wealth securely really rests on your trust in the legal system at this point to adjudicate things fairly and equitably and rapidly. My trust is completely gone in that regard. And then finally, and no, the insurance in the system, not even close to sufficient to deal with the actual magnitude of a true financial crisis. And oh, by the way, did I mention that there's $1 to $2 quadrillion of derivatives? But that's just derivatives. There are other qualified financial contracts, many, many hundreds of billions of dollars of them, all parked there, perfectly fine, perfectly safe, until such time as they are not. And you get that financial earthquake, and the next thing you know, uh-oh, right? Now we find out how many things are out of parameter, and the whole system could actually break down at that point in time. Speaking of which, there are other risks that I'm going to cover in part two of this for my subscribers back at Peak Prosperity. We would love to see you there for that. We have great conversations, and there's been so much content to talk about. And oh, by the way, you're going to want to know this. In a number of weeks from now, we are going to be holding a webinar which talks about exactly specifically the steps you can take to protect your wealth, protect your portfolios, protect what you have, given everything that we've just been talking about. I'm not here to make things seem more bad than they are, or spread fear, or offer any greed. I'm just going to say, look, it is what it is. This is the system. It's currently structured like this. Therefore, here are the things we can do to begin to make sure we're not the lowest hanging fruit in this story to get plucked when the next financial crisis comes. So keep an eye out for that. I know you're going to be interested in that. In the meantime, thank you so much for being here today and listening. I've had a wonderful time explaining all this and looking forward to your comments and your interactions with us very much. With that, thank you very much. See you next time. Bye-bye.